This is Gary Wakefield, and you're listening to Queer Life Stories.
My name is Noel Hourigan. I'm 58 years old, and I identify as a gay man. I grew up in a town called Traralgon in Gippsland. Spent the better part of the early 60s going to school in Traralgon in a Catholic school. And then when I was in grade six in primary school, I was sent to boarding school with my two brothers. I had two sisters go to boarding school in different places, so I went to an all-male Catholic boarding school run by the Maris brothers, who were freaks. And growing up, it was quite a great life. I come from a family of nine ultimately, so I'm seven of nine. We lived in outside of town and played around on the farm. It was easy back in those days. You could just jump on your bike and go swimming down the river, or tear off for hours on end riding or exploring. Had lots of other kids to play with, my siblings, but it was pretty carefree in those days. I didn't have any problems growing up. My father worked away from home. He was a surveyor, so he stayed close to the jobs that he was working on. So it was mostly my mother looking after us. She, I believe, was probably diagnosed manic depressive and self-medicated with alcohol. So as a consequence, that's one of the reasons we were sent to boarding school, because she wasn't looking after us all that well. So yeah, I started boarding school in grade six. Ended up staying there for 6 years. My parents separated when I was about 13. My father bought a house in Carlton in Melbourne. From boarding school, we were only allowed home one weekend a month. So either I went to stay with my mother, or we went to Melbourne for the school holidays. And I left school at when I was about 16, form five. And started an apprenticeship as a chef in Melbourne. Sexuality, I think, yes, I was sexualized quite early. There was even older kids that used to come out from town and be pursuing either my sister. But for me, was when I was in boarding school, in my first year there, and an older boy initiated sexual contact with me. So I thought, that's not too bad. I was basically quite early sexually active with other boys. And while I was at boarding school, over those years, there was a number of boys that I had contact with. Some of them were relationships over years, and others were sort of, short-lived, spasmodic liaisons with people. I came out at boarding school when I was 14. I told another boy that was from Melbourne, who I used to sleep next to, that I thought that I was attracted to boys. I told him because I thought he was a bit more sophisticated coming from Melbourne. But he, of course, then went and told someone else. So very quickly, the rumour went round that I was a poof. And so as a consequence, my nickname at school became Poof, and I wasn't known as anything other than Poof. That didn't perturb me too much, because I think I thought, well, I know who I am, so it didn't really hurt me that much. It did hurt a little bit, because the teasing that you got was sometimes from the boys that you were having sex with, and so that was a bit hard to basically hold your tongue and say, well, you know, it was all right yesterday. But and maybe the only other time it hurt me was in my final year of school, was the first year that they had introduced co-education teaching. So we went to school with the local Catholic girls in Form 5, and the first day of class, the teacher had an exercise where we had to write down our hobbies, and then people had to guess who that person was from their hobbies. And so it was read out that they liked netball and some other sort of girl thing, and one of the boys piped up, Noel Hurrigan. And it was most embarrassing on my first day with the girls to basically be outed like that. Some of the boys that I was having sex with were part of my close friend circle group. And but at the same time, it was very much nobody was to know about that. It was still very secretive. So the boys that I were having sex with, I knew that you could just never let it out, or they certainly wouldn't want it to be known, even amongst the other boys. So I think most of them I have trolled on Facebook, and they're all sort of married and got kids, so must have, you know, I don't think any of them sort of continued on with any of the sort of
they were experimenting.
So and since then I've only come across only a couple of people that I found out that I went to school with that were gay in the years since. But pretty much when I left school, I lost contact with a lot of the people that I went to school with. So I left school about 16 and came to Melbourne, to the family home in Carlton. I got an apprenticeship as a chef. So I used to ride to work, and in the street that we lived in, Fenwick Street in Carlton, there was a gay bar called the Union Hotel. And so I'd be riding home from work, and there would be these screaming queens coming out of the hotel after a good night. So it made me sort of nervous, I suppose. I was a bit sort of nervous, but it was about 18, around about 18. I used to go into town. There was another gay bar in Collins Street called the Australian Hotel. And I'd sit outside. I think I was too scared to go inside the pub, but I'd sit outside in the hope that some man might see me and take me away. My sex life with, outside of what happened in school, started with a waiter that I was working with. We sort of clicked that we were both queer, and he took me to my first gay bar, which was a famous place in Melbourne called Pokies, where they, on a Sunday night, they used to have drag shows and, you know, hundreds of people. And so that was my first gay bar when I was about 18. And then also at the same time, there was other gay bars that I went to, and I met a gang of people that I started hanging out with, my own age. You know, weekly we would go to the discotheque, you know, on the gay night that they had. Homosexuality had been decriminalised in 1980, so I was 19 when homosexuality was decriminalised. So it wasn't too bad on the street. I think still you had to be careful, and you know, like, you would get abused in the street because of your hairstyle or the clothes you wore. So you know, there was very much, you know, you'd be called faggot and woofter in the street. Early on, I did have a beer bottle in front of my face by some people that came across one of my early partners and I, and started harassing us for being gay. And the guy who had the beer bottle in front of my face, I just said, "Oh, don't be stupid," and miraculously he put it down. But it was, there was always that threat of violence. And so I didn't go to any of the beats or things like that in the early days. I had my first long-term relationship, a year and a half type of thing, when I was about 19.
Were you out to family and friends at that point?
Out to friends and out to my family in so far as my siblings. My elder brother, who is or was 8 years older than me. So I was 10 when he came out. And I remember my sister telling my mother, "You know, he's a poof, don't you?" And she said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous, you know, and don't say that in front of the other kids." And she, my sister said, "Oh, well, they know what it is." My mother's going, "Don't be ridiculous, you know, do you know what that means?" And we all said, "Yes." I don't think I really did, but so I suppose growing up, knowing that my older brother was gay, so by the time I reached about 13, 14, by the time I'd come out myself, I'd either seen him and his friends, and also next door to us at our family home, some friends of my sister's moved in. Their older brother, Michael, was gay, and they also lived with another young chef, gay. So they were, well, I suppose in those days, for people like my brother, especially coming out in the early 70s, I think there was an expectation that you almost like a very camp, as they called it then, like what we probably call the Screaming Queen now. But for them, that was a way for them to gain acceptance. People, if they went to parties in drag or, you know, camped it up a lot, it was, people found it funny. And and so that, in a sense, for them was protection, you know, made it sort of funny, and people seemed to accept them more. But for me, I suppose, seeing that when I was about 13 or 14, I thought, well, I don't want to have to pretend to be something. I just wanted to be a person. I just wanted to, you know, not have to, I didn't feel like I needed to camp it up or behave differently because of my sexuality. And I suppose also at the time, for me in the early 80s, I was probably growing up into young punk and listening to punk music and styling and what have you. So there was lots of you know, bands and discos, and it was really quite easy to move out in the entertainment world and sort of, you know, not really be singled out because of your sexuality. Seemed to be sort of like almost accepted. That's not to say that I haven't gone on to suffer homophobia since then. You know, we've been chased down the street, we've had somebody after us with a baseball bat, I've been punched in the head, told that there's no cure for AIDS. So, you know, I have faced homophobia, not in a terribly discriminatory way with employment or anything like that. Probably when I, you know, first started working, I would have kept my sexuality hidden because I, you know, like it still wasn't sort of great to be out, I suppose. But so my siblings would have known. I didn't probably come out. I didn't sort of sit anyone down and say, I've got something to tell you. I, because of my older brother being gay, it was sort of like in the family. So I just started bringing boys home to stay. And so, you know, everyone's just clued up that, oh, you know, mom's had a boy. So I never came out as such. I think I was sort of just lived my life. So I never came out to my mother. She died when I was 17. So I never, you know, had to come out to her. And I never, as such, came out to my father. Like, I just had my boyfriend come around and visit, and I thought it was just plainly obvious. But I was to find out some years later, probably when I was about 25, and my dad asked my sister where I was, and she said I was probably with his boyfriend, and dad didn't, like, what, you know? And so my sister said, well, you know, yeah, Noel's gay, and so's Greg, my younger brother. And I think that was a bit of a shock to my dad. He obviously just must have had his blinkers on. He thought I was going out with my best friend Susan, who I used to do house painting with. So my sister told him, and then the next day he had a massive heart attack and died. So for years I thought, oh my God, the news that he found out three of his sons are gay, it's fucking killed him. So I did have the guilt for years, but then I just thought, oh no, bullshit. But somehow for years, yes, I thought that the news for my poor father finding out that three of his four sons were gay gave him a heart attack. But I finished my apprenticeship and started working in a hotel, and then decided to go overseas. So in 1982, I went to Europe. I had my 21st in a gay bar in Amsterdam, and after that you could get a working visa for 2 years in England. So I lived in London from 1982 to 1984. That was a fantastic time, also for music, fashion, and the nightclubs. There was this massive nightclub in Charing Cross called Heaven, and it was in an old air raid shelter. Absolutely massive. And so there was people like Boy George and Marilyn and other people like that around at the time, the Bronski Beat. So there was quite a number of gay bars and clubs that were on in London at the time. One of them was in Angel, and you'd have to walk past a skinhead pub to get to the gay pub. And it's just absolutely scare the shit out of me, getting off at the tube at Angel and then having to sort of like walk past the skinhead bar. I was probably in London at the time when there was sort of news of a gay disease going around. It had mostly been diagnosed in America. And so safe sex in the early days was don't have sex with an American. There was not, and especially even in England, even though there was news of it coming out in the early 80s. Yeah, it was getting reported in the early 80s. But still not a lot of education. There was no safe sex messaging really in those days, because people didn't know how it was even transmitted. They thought if you kissed somebody or touched them or drank from the same glass of water of them, that you would get HIV. So there was fear and a scare campaign. When I came back to Melbourne in the mid 80s, 84, I had a relationship with a boy for about 18 months and we split up. And he went to Darwin and was saying that he was sick, and the doctors didn't know what it was and thought it might have been Ross River fever or something. And he eventually came back to Melbourne and rang me that day, and he was placed into Fairfield Hospital, which was the infectious diseases hospital in Melbourne. He had to tell his mum, not only am I gay, but I have HIV. So I started visiting Greg at Fairfield and went in there almost daily. It was pretty much the early days of people getting sick, so the wards where the other boys were, and I suppose at that time too it was you know, absolutely frightening, because there was things like how HIV affected you, affected everyone differently. So there was things like Kaposi's sarcoma, where they'd have purple blotches and bruises over them, or it might affect their brain, or lung and respiratory conditions. And it was also early days for the hospital and treatments. So there was a lot of sick people in the ward. And Greg basically was in there for 3 months and just deteriorated over that 3 months and then died. So he was the first of many friends that died. It was sort of like a time too that yeah, so people started dying, people were sick, and you didn't have time to grieve for a person when you had to be sort of strong to help who you were looking after and to support them the best you could. I had at that time another very good friend, Anthony, that was HIV. He kept going into Fairfield with some illness, get treated, come out, get sick again, go back into Fairfield. So I eventually became Anthony's carer, and he moved, we moved back to Sydney. So he was getting treated at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, where the same thing was happening. The ward there was full of men in various forms of how HIV was affecting them. So yeah, it was really quite confronting. Even once again, the drugs that Anthony were on, there was basically just a window of only a couple of hours in the day when he, what would you call sort of any sense of normality in a living life. The rest of the time he was just sick from the drug, sick, you know, shaking. So it was yeah, it was a pretty hard time to be around. He eventually just said, you know, I've had enough of this. And so we called in his family and we called a doctor that was part of the community, and with his family and friends beside him, the doctor gave him basically an overdose, but that's what he wanted, and it was you know, it was good, but even though it was against the law at the time, but because some people's lives were just becoming so hideous that you know, there was a few doctors that would treat people in a palliative way. Also at the time there was a lot of protests for HIV awareness, against stigma, protests for better treatment, what have you, better response. even though Australia did have a very good response to HIV and education, we were sort of very good at doing that in Australia. But it was just the time. There was a lot of people becoming diagnosed, and especially in the early days, it was, you know, it was a death sentence. There was also a very good response in Melbourne. So people got together very early and started campaigning and also raising awareness. The lesbians came and teamed up with the guys, and also, you know, like the early days of people getting ill. So there was support there in various forms. So David Wintz and Fund, you know, because people were getting sick, their loss of income, that sort of thing. So there was groups there to support people. I found out in the mid-90s that both of my brothers were HIV. My older brother, Brendan, he didn't want anyone to know. He didn't want to be treated differently. He was a hairdresser, so it could have even affected his business that people thought, oh, I'm not getting my hair cut by a guy that's HIV. So I respected his decision, and eventually, he, over the years, he got sicker and sicker to the point where he basically needed care. So I finished up my job and became his carer. He also had a number of hospital stays, was on a huge drug regimes. Eventually in 2000, he went into emergency one day, and the doctor said, there's nothing we can do for him. The drugs that we've been giving him have basically fucked up his liver and his organs. He, within days, had died. So that was pretty confronting. And he was a great brother. And
sorry.
It's, yeah, grief. You just had to be strong for to, you know, look after the people that you cared for. And then besides that, there was, just because you were in the gay community, there was just other people that you knew about, that even if they weren't, you know, terribly close friends, they were part of the community, that were also dying. So it was incredibly sad. Because they were just such talented, amazing, beautiful people dying in their 20s and early 30s. So it was just really, really shocking. And yeah, I'm very, very, very affected by the grief of that period. Still to this day, I carry that grief. And it's almost like a post-traumatic stress syndrome. You know, when I'm confronted with now people dying of cancer, friends dying of cancer, it's every death brings back those HIV deaths and that period. It's like an accumulative sort of thing. From the early 80s, we'd achieved decriminalisation. There'd been, you know, people like my older brother starting gay rights movement in the early 70s in Melbourne. He was very much part of that. So, you know, we'd had years of campaigns, I suppose. The biggest sadness was that, you know, we got to decriminalisation and more sort of acceptance of homosexuals. And then the AIDS crisis came, and we were once again the pariahs and spreaders of disease, and you know, bashings increased, especially Sydney, and you know, we now know of the horrific years of people being murdered along the cliffs in Sydney, bashings at beats and things like that. Yeah, the early 80s and mid 80s, we found ourselves under attack again because of HIV, and probably discrimination again, you know, like if for instance, walking down the street with my arm around my partner, they would walk past and go, you know, "Hate faggots," and you go, "Why?" And it was because you spread disease, you know. So yeah, in a sense, you know, we had this wonderful sort of, you know, rise to acceptance, but then we also then became persecuted again because of HIV. In the late 80s, so around about the time that Greg was in Fairfield, I just started art school, and I met my current partner, Dennis, and we've been together since that time. So pretty much, yeah, just living and working and continuing my relationship with Dennis. So I suppose also because I was in a relationship, I didn't, and especially my partner, Dennis, wasn't, when we met, he had been in a relationship with a woman for 7 years, and so he didn't come part, he wasn't part of the gay scene, not like I was, and you know, from going to gay clubs when I was, you know, 18 and 19 and things like that. So Dennis had never been part of that life. And so, you know, if I did go out, it was usually by myself without Dennis. He didn't feel the need to, you know, be part of that life in a sense, and still probably doesn't. I suppose just got on with my life. About 96, I moved to Bendigo to work at the Bendigo Art Gallery, and so I've been in Bendigo for 14 years now. Once again, I've got a great friendship base here, something that I almost walked into. I make a joke that I came to Bendigo and met the A-list, and hasn't changed since. But through a dear friend, Lizzie Rockefeller, who I met soon after arriving here, and we formed a very close friendship, and within months she'd been diagnosed with breast cancer, and then found out that it was advanced and she was given 5 to 10 years to live. So we had Lizzie for 5 years, but through Lizzie, she was the catalyst for a whole group of beautiful people here in Bendigo. And we've, so since Lizzie's death 9 years ago, we've continued with that friend group, and we meet every year on her death anniversary, which also happens to be World's AIDS Day. So World's AIDS Day for me is always a very big day, not only remembering people that have gone, but also for Lizzie, who I dearly miss as well. When I came to Bendigo was interesting in so far as they did have a monthly gay night that was well attended from people that came from surrounding districts to, and it was really quite fun. The other thing in Bendigo was that they'd already started, been running for a couple of years, was the Bendigo Queer Film Festival. Upon arriving in Bendigo, yes, I quickly got to know the gay group here, and then volunteered to work on the committee for the Bendigo Queer Film Festival. So I organised the annual Queer Country Art Exhibition as part of the festival, and I ended up doing that for 12 years and recently retired from that. There was a group in Bendigo called CAN, that was the Country Awareness Network, which earlier days was the Country AIDS Network, but because of the changes in AIDS, they changed the name to Awareness. So there was a place where you could get the gay newspapers, free condoms, any messaging and support. So I used to do volunteer for them, especially say around World AIDS Day, where it was quite good that they also did events for World AIDS Day, which was great in a rural area to have someone campaigning for that, which was good. I ended up working with them for 6 months on a project to get messaging out to rural gay guys about sexual health. That was a interesting period. But so yeah, I've tried to be involved in especially local gay scene, education around HIV, sexually transmitted diseases. I also, through the council 2 years ago, worked with the seniors in the community, and I made a little short film with Izzy Sudi called LGBTI Histories Untold Stories. So we interviewed 12 seniors about their lives, them growing up, their activism. That was a very great project to work on. So you can watch that on YouTube.
I'll put a link.
Yeah, good. But currently I've stepped back from the community a bit. I resigned from the Bendigo Queer Film Festival committee. I got a bit disillusioned with the community. There was nobody stepping up. It seemed like everything was being run by the same people or just heavily reliant on some volunteers. That causes burnout, and nobody was stepping up to take over these roles. And I sort of thought, well, there's just been a big shift in the community. I mean, when I was growing up, there was definitely a need to be together and to campaign together and to support each other and that sense of community. But I feel that that's totally disintegrated now, or it's totally different from the 30 years or so that we had, a strong gay community. Type of thing. People seem to have fragmented. It's online, more sort of, maybe sticking within their subgroups and what have you. So maybe there wasn't a need, but as we learnt, there was a need because we had a plebiscite thrust upon us. At the time, I found that incredibly hard, only because it felt like we were fighting for our rights again, like 30 years after fighting for our rights and for equality and to be respected. And social media became a fucking shit fight with people, and maybe people from, religious organizations. And I think trans people became the most vilified group from that. So it was very, it was absolutely depressing time and severely impacted people's mental health. We were lucky in Bendigo to have a very good campaign for the yes vote. We ended up getting a 67.9% vote from Bendigo, which was incredibly good. That was a huge relief the day of the announcement, and also to know that we had that many people to support us in Bendigo, so it was really good. I'm currently working as a disability support worker. I have three clients from the LGBTI community, and that's been sort of part of their goal was to have more contact with the LGBTI, so I've been very fortunate to be able to work with those people. One in particular had never been to a Pride march, So when we did go down to Melbourne to the Pride March, he thought that was the best day of his life and couldn't believe that walking down the street that people were cheering and clapping you for being gay. And, you know, that was very humbling for me and a great honour to be able to assist him to do that, you know. I know that it can be incredibly hard depending on where you come from, and that also might be from your family if you have a homophobic family. It must be incredibly sad and horrible growing up in that environment. But ultimately, if your family doesn't accept you for who you are, fucking get rid of them. Just get rid of them. Leave and make them. I would say just be yourselves, you know, and be proud of who you are. Be proud of who you are. It's, you know, it's just sexuality. It's got nothing to do with anybody else, really. It's up to you. And if people are going to, you know, bully you or treat you differently because of that, they're people that you do not want to know. And if they can't accept you, you know, that's their problem. It's not your problem. You know, be who you are and be proud.
Great. Thank you.
That's all right.
If you're struggling with your own mental health, please contact Lifeline on 13114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224636. Both services are available 24/7. If you would like to tell your story, share your experiences, or would just like to get in touch, please email us at queerlifestories@outlook.com. Or you can find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Queer Life Stories. This podcast is a no-budget, one-man operation to produce, but you can support this podcast by donating or subscribing to us at Patreon. That's patreon.com/queerlifestories. If you're listening in Tasmania and would like support regarding your sexuality, gender, or intersex status, contact Working It Out on 6231 1200 or find them on Facebook. QLife provide anonymous and free LGBTI peer support and referral for people across Australia wanting to talk about sexuality, gender identity, relationships, and more. They're available 3 p.m. to midnight every day on 1800 184 527, or you can web chat with them at qlife.org.au. You can hear future episodes of Queer Life Stories on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Please follow, subscribe, rate, review, and share. We will be back soon. Thank you for listening. Take care of yourself and each other.